Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is July 30, 1979, and this is my audio letter number 48. In recent weeks, we Americans have been reeling from one crisis to another. The gasoline crisis, the dollar crisis, with gold peaking at new record levels, the fall of Nicaragua, the alleged crash to earth of Skylab, rumors of a new Russia military command in Cuba, controversy over the SALT II treaty, and above all, the Carter crisis, with one shocking and unprecedented development after another. Meanwhile, in the background there is a continuing drumbeat of lesser mysteries to worry about. Chemical plants, refineries, and oil storage depots keep exploding and burning daily all around us. Railroad tank cars keep derailing, leaking, and exploding here and there. But these things have become so commonplace in the past 2 years that we hardly even pay attention anymore. Instead, we wonder, why did those 41 sperm whales suddenly beach themselves and die last month on the Oregon coast? Even the marine biologists in that area leave us with the words, "It may always be a mystery." But that soon fades from our minds, and instead our attention is diverted by pathetic television reruns of America's heyday in space a decade ago. As we watch the fuzzy picture of a spaceman as he steps gingerly onto the moon, for a moment it is once again July 20, 1969, and for a brief moment we thrill once again to those famous words of Neil Armstrong, "That's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind." For a moment, we may forget how different it is today. Our manned space station Skylab is now officially dead, according to NASA, while Russian cosmonauts are setting new records in their Salyut 6 space station. And strangely, the American space shuttle just can't seem to get off the ground. What's happened to NASA, we may ask ourselves? And if we could land men on the moon, why can't we solve any of our other problems? But before we can think of any answers, our attention is diverted again. "Here comes another bombshell from Washington," says the TV, and we forget everything else, absorbed in the latest bewildering event in the Carter crisis. My friends, news reports about these events always make them seem as if they were separate and unrelated. As a result, they seem to make no sense. And so, we do as we are intended to do, we just throw up our hands. The more evil our leaders have become, the more we have decided to just trust them. And the more secretive our government has become, the more we have lied to ourselves that we knew what was going on. But the events I mentioned a few moments ago are not separate and unrelated. They are all parts of a bigger picture. Like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, each piece makes sense when you know what the total picture is. That is why in my audio letter series, I keep focusing on the total picture. That is what I said I would do when I inaugurated the audio letter series in June 1975. Each month, I can only highlight a few of the specific events that are pieces of the puzzle. But each month, I try to add more to your own understanding so that you can learn to see the truth for yourself. For long-time careful listeners of my audio letters, recent events ought not to be any real surprise. For example, consider the fluctuating decline of the United States dollar and the fluctuating rise of gold prices. Lately, many former anti-gold figures have jumped onto the gold bandwagon as if they had always been there. Yet they tell you nothing about why these events are now taking place. My friends, the reasons are those which I made public 6 years ago in my book, 5 years ago in congressional testimony, and then in my audio letters. Those who expected to benefit most from the death of the dollar began vanishing from the scene early this year of 1979. This began with the murder of Nelson Rockefeller, which I reported in Audio Letter 42. The following month, I reported that his brothers David and Lawrence were also killed and replaced with doubles. It is now widely known in international banking circles that the real David Rockefeller is dead. The powerful long-range economic forces were unleashed years ago by the late David Rockefeller and his intimates. The death of a dollar was just one part of an elaborate plan for dictatorship here in America, followed by a one-world government. Another element of the plan was to be a Middle East war with the nuclear destruction of Arab OPEC oil wells. Over 3.5 years ago, I made the plan public in audio letter 6, and in later tapes, for example, numbers 28, 37, and 41, I have kept my listeners informed about the status of this plan. And in audio letter 41 last December 1978, I called attention to the Hate Saudi Arabia campaign, which was building up here in America. The nuclear doom of Saudi Arabia was being planned for the spring, and the American people were being conditioned to accept it. In audio letter 37, I had revealed the secret American plan by which the Middle East disaster was to lead to war with Russia. In March came the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, which was designed to set the stage not for peace, but for war. But in late April 1979, events behind the scenes altered completely the direction of events. In audio letter 46 2 months ago, I revealed how Russia stopped the secret nuclear war plan in its tracks, especially after the death of David Rockefeller. Meanwhile, only the tip of the iceberg of all this showed up here in America. Most Americans only knew that there was a gasoline shortage with long lines. What we were not told was that the so-called shortage was artificial. It had been timed to coincide with the Saudi Arabian disaster, which did not happen due to Russia's intervention. Now the oil companies are covering their tracks, releasing more gasoline, and most Americans still have no idea what the gas lines were really all about. And then there are those whales which beached themselves last month in Oregon. It was almost a rerun of the beaching of some 120 whales in Florida nearly 2.5 years ago. In audio letter 20 for January 1977, I had revealed that some huge secret American underwater missiles had been planted in the Atlantic Ocean off our east coast. These enormous missiles had begun rupturing and leaking plutonium from their warheads into the ocean. Early the following month, the whales began beaching themselves near Jacksonville, Florida. The stories then were the same as we heard recently in Oregon. Somehow, we were told, the Florida whales must have gotten disoriented. But as I revealed in audio letter 21, their breathing had been disrupted by a fungus in their lungs. And the fungus was the product of the plutonium from one of the leaking missiles I had revealed. This time in Oregon, the whale beaching was once again caused by plutonium-induced fungus in the lungs. But the source this time was not a leaking underwater missile. Instead, a different weapon of secret warfare mentioned in audio letters 20 and 21 is involved. Recently, Russia resumed radiochemical warfare against the United States. Large remote control canisters have been dropped at sea at intervals along our Pacific, Atlantic, and Gulf coasts. These are spewing radiochemical warfare agents into our air on command whenever wind conditions are favorable. Most of the canisters use plutonium as one of their active ingredients. These renewed attacks so far are at a low non-lethal level. Their purpose is not to kill, but to promote low-grade ailments and to sap our strength and national will. But the whales that beached themselves on the Oregon coast last month, June 16th, had high concentrations of plutonium in their lungs, along with the other canister products. Apparently, they surfaced very close to a canister off the Oregon coast. They breathe the air just as you and I do, and at that close range, the canister gave them a dose that destroyed their ability to breathe. And so, like the whales in Florida 2.5 years ago, they beached themselves to die. In other ways, too, the United States is gradually being rendered incapable of going to war against Russia. In World War II, the Western Allies brought Germany's war machine to a crawl by bombing chemical plants and disrupting rail transportation. Likewise, today American chemical, petroleum, and rail targets are being destroyed in a war of attrition by Russian sabotage. Russia's new rulers are taking no chances, my friends. Of all people, they know there is always the danger of being surprised and upset in their plans. And so, even while they are trying to prevent nuclear war, they are still preparing to win such a war if it does take place. This even includes continuing preparations for a possible invasion of the United States from Canada and Mexico. I first revealed these activities 16 months ago in Audio Letter 32. And this is the explanation for the news reports just a few days ago about a major new Russian Army command structure in Cuba. Cuba is serving as a staging center for the steady flow of troops and arms into Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. This is going on secretly, but with the knowledge and cooperation of the Mexican government. Early this year, President Carter paid a visit to Mexico and was greeted with official contempt and hostility. Now you know why. Mexico, like Quebec Province in Canada, has already made her peace with Russia. Russia's preparations are already far advanced to enable her to survive and win all-out war. And yet, as I have revealed over the past several months, Russia's new rulers are using every means at their disposal to prevent nuclear war. They are doing nothing less than taking control of the United States, working from the top down. Today, I want to call your attention to major current events, which are proving what I have been telling you all along. Because the audio letter stands alone, you must use your own judgment in evaluating what I reveal, instead of depending on what anyone else says. The audio letter, my friends, is not for the many, but for the few with ears to hear. My three special topics this month are: Topic number 1, the final chapter in the Great Skylab cover-up. Topic number 2, the secret war of the Walking Dead. And topic number 3, how America will relearn the fear of God. Topic number 1. On a midsummer day 10 years ago this month, an estimated 500 million people worldwide sat transfixed before television sets. We were watching a television image that was fuzzy, flickering in black and white, and yet it was awesome. Because we were watching the impossible take place before our very eyes. We were watching two American astronauts, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, the first two men on the moon. That day, July 20, 1969, was a great day to be an American. The impossible promise of an assassinated President John F. Kennedy had come true. On May 25, 1961, he had told us that America would put a man on the moon before the decade was out. So when Neil Armstrong stepped onto the moon's surface and called it a giant leap, he was right. In barely 8 years, we had leapfrogged past Russia to be first on the moon. In Audio Letter 26, I explained why it was so important to beat Russia to the moon. It was all sold to us as a sort of space age Olympics, a peaceful sporting race to gather moon rocks. But it was actually a military crash program, 10 times bigger than the Manhattan Project in World War II. And its real purpose was to establish a secret base on the moon. From there, revolutionary new beam weapons would become the key to ruling the Earth. At the time of the Kennedy announcement in 1961, the United States was far behind Russia in space. but NASA planners had figured out a way to jump past Russia in order to get to the moon first. The Russians were firmly committed to what is called the Earth orbital approach to moon flight. Under this approach, missions to the moon would be assembled and launched from Earth orbit with the aid of space stations. This technique has always been recognized as the surest and safest route to the moon. Even our own late great Wernher von Braun had advocated the Earth orbital approach for more than a decade. The Earth orbital technique is like building a firm foundation before building the rest of the house. It's the right thing to do, but it takes time. NASA planners were given the task of beating Russia to the moon, and they soon concluded that we were too far behind Russia to catch up by the Earth orbital method. There was only one way we could beat the Russians. It was bold, but it was also very risky. It would be like building a house with almost no foundation for the sake of speed. It was called the Lunar Orbital Moon Mission. Under this plan, the first priority was to get men on the moon fast and start laying the groundwork for a moon base. Then, with the moon in American hands, we could drop back and fortify our space logistics system. Its keystone was to be a space station known as Skylab. And that's how Project Apollo was conceived, with its predecessors Project Mercury and Project Gemini. NASA was gambling in several ways at once, but the gamble paid off. America did beat Russia to the moon. In December 1972, the moon program was supposedly cut off prematurely with Apollo 17. But in AUDIO LETTER 26, I explained that the flights did not really stop. Instead, the moon program was simply taken out of public limelight. Moon launch missions were shifted from the highly visible Cape Kennedy to the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. On May 14, 1973, less than 5 months after the Apollo 17 moon mission, Skylab was launched. From then on, the secretly continuing American moon program began benefiting from Earth orbital techniques. By late 1977, plans called for the American military base in Copernicus Crater to be armed and operational. The base was to be armed with beam weapons, which can blast any visible spot on Earth within 2 seconds. The weapons were to include, eventually, both lasers and particle beams. In the United States itself, particle beam research had been sent down blind alleys as a decoy. But in other locations worldwide, particle beam weapons were being developed. It was an elaborate plan, and it almost worked. But on the night of the Harvest Moon, September 27, 1977, it all ended in catastrophe. Already the Soviet Union had begun orbiting operational killer satellites called Cosmos Interceptors. These are manned and armed with particle beam weapons. Two were in orbit by late September 1977, and one was armed with a deadly neutron beam. This was used to bombard the Copernicus base, killing all the astronauts there, as I reported in AUDIO LETTER 26. Only 2 days later, the Russian manned space program suddenly came to life. The Salyut 6 space station was launched into orbit. Then cosmonaut crews began visiting Salyut 6 in a steady stream, which continues to this day. Even now, the later Salyut 6 cosmonauts have been in orbit more than 150 days. This far exceeds any record ever set by the United States. All this is in stark contrast to the fate of our own space station, Skylab. Earlier this month, on July 11, NASA pretended that Skylab had unavoidably crashed from orbit. But Skylab actually came to an abrupt end 21 months ago, as I reported in AUDIO LETTER 27. On October 18, 1977, a tremendous fireball flashed across the southwestern United States. The sky was lit up over a track nearly 1,000 miles long. It was seen by thousands across at least 5 states, Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Missouri. Witnesses included pilots, military observers, and even the McDonald Observatory in far southwest Texas. It produced headlines all over the United States. People were asking, what in the world was that? That, my friends, was Skylab. As I said that month, it was blasted out of space by a Russian Cosmos interceptor. The destruction of Skylab was part of Russia's program to terminate America's secret military control of space. Later that month, the Skylab cover-up by NASA got underway. Skylab was said to be sinking from orbit sooner than expected. But at first, NASA pretended the Skylab could probably be saved by the space shuttle. There was never any chance, my friends, the Skylab could be saved, because it was already gone. From time to time, the Skylab cover-up story was revived, each time with more pessimism. Finally, last December 1978, NASA announced, with deep regret, of course, that all plans to rescue Skylab were being abandoned. Those pesky sunspots were just bringing it down too fast to reach it in time with the space shuttle. From then on, speculation mounted. Where would Skylab crash? India? China? The Andes? Russia? Downtown Chicago? NASA spokesman kept insisting that they had no idea. Even on the alleged final orbit this month, July 11, NASA pretended to be taken by surprise. They pretended to be trying to bring it down in the South Atlantic, but it overshot, they said. Then there were several minutes of dramatic silence from Skylab Control in Houston. Then came the initial announcement of Skylab's official fate. Purely by chance, they said, Skylab had apparently crashed into the Indian Ocean. They pretended it was a surprise. But 17 months ago, my friends, I alerted you to the Indian Ocean as being on NASA's mind for cover-up purposes. The Indian Ocean provides no witnesses to dispute NASA's claim of a Skylab reentry there. Nevertheless, NASA finally decided it would be much safer to provide something for people to see than to say it just disappeared without a trace. And sure enough, the initial NASA announcement about the Indian Ocean was followed by reports of sparkles in the sky over southwest Australia. NASA then said apologetically that a few portions of Skylab had apparently made it past the ocean, re-entering over western Australia. But strangely enough, the Australian government said not a word. My friends, this final chapter of the Skylab cover-up involved another military secret, which I made public in Audio Letter 42. There's a large secret American missile base in the Northern Territory of Australia. The base is controlled by the military, not NASA. But Skylab was part of a secret military program, and so NASA received some military help in the Skylab cover-up. On July 8, only 3 days before Skylab's fictional crash to Earth, a worldwide military exercise called Global Shield 79 began. It received very little publicity here in the United States, and yet it was the biggest exercise in over 20 years by the Strategic Air Command. NASA scheduled the fictional end of Skylab to take place during this exercise. On July 10, two Minuteman III missiles were launched into the Pacific from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. But that same day, another missile was also launched under cover of the worldwide exercise. It was launched from the missile base in Australia in coordination with NASA. The missile was unarmed, and so the Russian Cosmospheres overhead observed the launch without interfering. It was launched shortly past noon Eastern Daylight Time, which was the middle of the night in Australia. The missile headed northeast over Indonesia and the South Pacific into orbit. Nearly 24 hours later, the orbital package was following the path that would soon bring it over Australia once again. A small retro rocket was fired, and re-entry took place over southwest Australia. It was time for maximum effect, nighttime in Australia and midday in the United States. The orbital package, consisting of ceramic fragments of a special design, created a nice fireworks display in the night sky. The very next day, reports in the United States said that Australians were finding pieces of purported Skylab debris lying all around. And in the most famous case, an alleged 17-year-old beer keg delivery man swung into action like a professional. Traveling by chartered Learjet, commercial airplane, and limousine, he raced to San Francisco. Carrying a few nondescript black lumps, he beat the deadline for the $10,000 Skylab prize offered by the San Francisco Examiner. Those lumps, my friends, were merely chunks of volcanic rock consisting mostly of iron and carbon. But predictably, NASA said a few days later that they were probably from Skylab, and the prize was awarded. Can you imagine? My friends, NASA has now closed the book on Skylab. It's just yesterday's news now, something we are supposed to forget about. But if we do forget it, we would deserve whatever may happen to us. Because the Skylab cover-up was elaborate, and its purpose was to keep the truth from us. There are still very powerful forces in America who want to drag us all into war with Russia. But the message of Skylab is that if we let that happen, we will be committing suicide for ourselves, for our children, and for the United States of America.